Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. You can add another feather in the cap for the Sacramento community. The Sacramento Observer is the nation's best Black newspaper. Not only that, the paper also racked up more than a dozen of other awards at the National Newspaper Publishers Association a few weeks ago. The Best Black Newspaper Award is actually not the Observer's first. In fact, the paper has now won that award for the seventh time in its 60-year history. The Observer was founded in Sacramento back in 1962 by local businessman and real estate broker William Hanford Lee. After his passing in 2019, his son, Larry Lee, took over the Sac Observer and continues to run it today. Larry joins us now with what makes a paper so special. Larry, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you for having me, Vic.
Nice to see you, especially under the circumstances. So we're going to get to these big accomplishments in just a moment, but let's just start with the Sacramento Observer itself. It has such a rich history in our community that really begins with your family. You grew up with really understanding the power of local journalism. Why did your father start the Observer?
Oh, I think, and I don't want to forget the other two gentlemen, Gino Gladden and John Cole, who were right alongside of him, as well as the families, the wives that were there as well, too, that helped start the paper. It was really out of a need for, the community, the African-American community having a voice. You're talking about 1962. The African-American experience was not necessarily documented anywhere else. And, you know, you're in the midst of, civil rights, period. And so there was a publication that preceded the Observer called the Sacramento Outlook. It was more of a religious publication, wasn't printed with the frequency of a regular newspaper. And so these three decided to start it. The responsibility of it fell quickly to my family as Gino Gladden passed away pretty early and John Cole was kind of like a serial businessman. And so he would have, lots of different business ideas and ventures. So my dad took to it pretty quickly in November of 62 after they started. And really within 10 years, he had really catapulted the Observer into, the upper echelon of the Black press, which historically has, quite an amazing legacy. It's the nation's first Black business and has been responsible for countless achievements and changes for the African-American community across the country. And he just dove right into that legacy and that history and never really looked back.
Was entering journalism, running the Sac Observer as you do now, was that knee-jerk for you? Is that something you always wanted to do?
You know, the funny thing, I will say this much, is I am a very appreciative of, I'm the youngest of three boys. Was born in 1973, which was actually the first year that The Observer ever was named the nation's best Black newspaper. I teasingly told my dad it wasn't until I was born that The Observer really started to do to start winning great awards. But, I think the thing that I would say that my parents gave me, pretty young, is it gave me purpose. So I was very aware of what the Observer was doing for the African-American community on a week-in, week-out basis of through the print product of the newspaper. I was fortunate enough to have gone to San Jose State during the midst of the Silicon Valley growth and everything there. And so I was paying attention very early, 18, 19 years old, of what does media look like? What is a local community newspaper? How does it survive? How does it grow? What are some of the things that we can do with technology to kind of bolster our audience and reach them where they are? And so so that purpose that they gave me, and I say they gave me purpose because they literally asked me, do you want to have anything to do with the family business, when I was about 18 years old? I think they were in their own season trying to decide whether or not they were going to hold on to it or sell it or whatever they might do. And, so the knee-jerk reaction was me saying yes, not really knowing everything that I was getting myself into.
And then figuring it out.
And then figuring it out, absolutely. But I absolutely love the work that we do and I told someone the other day, I was born in the Black press and I will die in the Black press.
You know, given that the Observer has been around for over 60 years, I would imagine this paper has weathered, you know, quite a few storms to still be relevant and still be impactful today. How has the Observer grown and what challenges did it have to overcome?
Oh, gosh. You know, the first of all, the challenge of being a family business in and of itself is a challenge. The challenge of being, you know, an African-American Black-owned business is very challenging. And then you throw in there the news industry and the challenges that it has faced. So, you know, challenges come every day, it seems like. I think what, you know, I learned is that they are just challenges. And sometimes they're opportunities to kind of show what you can do. And I think that, you know, I personally have developed, I believe, a really strong tolerance for really difficult times and being able to kind of keep my eye very focused on what we're trying to do. I say often that God has given us vision and provision. He's given us, and I say us, I'm saying collectively me, but he's given us a direction of what we want to do to help serve this community. And really, that's really where it comes from, too, is knowing the conditions that African Americans are faced with each and every day, that gives us such great motivation to help serve that community in the best way possible. The gift that I've been given is the work of the Observer and the tools of how do we do that through journalism and community engagement and, you know, all the other different ways in which you amplify the challenges as well as the joys of our community, which there's so many things that often just get overlooked by mainstream press. And that's why we're here. And so, you know, we've had difficult financial times, staffing challenges. It's just all, you know, advertising challenges, the change of technology, all those things have hit us. But we just kind of put our head down and stay very focused and committed to what we're doing each and every day.
Yeah, and this year is a good year to kind of pat yourselves on the back because you just received the best Black newspaper in the nation. Tell us about this award since it's the seventh time the Observer has received it.
Sure. So NNPA, the National Newspaper Publishers Association, of which we're a member, is kind of what we would call the Black press of America. There's about 200 Black newspapers across the country. Some of them are in communities that are very underserved, rural communities and the like, but some of them are in major metropolitan, what we would call chocolate cities. You know, we have a story online right now about the blackest cities in the United States, and cities like Detroit and Baltimore, where there's 60-70% African American population. You know, so the NNPA really are Black Press Awards are kind of like our Pulitzers. It's where they judge all of our work over the last year or so. Now, the Observer honestly has not entered the competition. We have not entered the competition in 20 years. 2003 was the last time we entered. In the last 30 years, we've only entered twice.
Why?
In all honesty, I think a lot of it was so. There's a couple of things. One, if you in our business. It's kind of hard pulling all the entries together.
It is a lot of work.
When you're a weekly newspaper, you have to literally go through every publication, every story, and kind of look at it with a critical eye. And there's been times when we just didn't have the bandwidth to do it. It just didn't. We had, for the better part of the last 15 years, you know, we've been, you know, kind of a very small staff. And so, you know, the time and dedication on kind of pulling those together was time consuming. I will say, however, I was very motivated and have been very motivated the last couple of years because we have made some tremendous progress as an organization. And I really wanted to highlight the work that we've been doing. And so, you know, pulling the entries together was something that we were very focused on doing this year. We entered there's 23 total categories. We entered 18 of the categories. Of the 18, we were awarded in 14. And then unbeknownst to me, The publishers named me Publisher of the Year. And I was...
It just keeps getting better.
It was, and that comes about 30 days after we were acknowledged and recognized by the California Newspaper Publishers Association as the third best weekly in the state of California. And to us, that was very significant because there are communities in California, as you know, that, you know, have really struggled with news as news deserts. And so the weeklies tend to be, in some communities, the primary publication of that community. And for CNPA to recognize a niche publication like ours, where African Americans can get around their life without the Observer each and every day. But the fact that they recognize kind of our high impact journalism in particular that we've been doing over the last couple of years was, you know, confirmation about, you know, what we're doing as an organization.
Yeah. And it really takes a village to do the kind of work that The Observer is doing. We actually have, at Cap Radio, have a unique partnership with The Observer.
Yes.
We share a reporter, Srishti Prabha, who reports on Sacramento K-12 education. They do a great job. How did this partnership come about? And what is some of the work that Srishti's done that stands out to you?
Sure. And I want to acknowledge the entire staff, really, for The Observer. As I said, we had a shoestring team, and many of whom are still around, and I'm very appreciative of the work that they've done over the years and hanging with us. But I have so much excitement about, you know, kind of this new generation of people that we've been able to kind of bring into the newsroom. The relationship really started, you know, for several years, particularly after the killing of Stephon Clark, kind of a closer relationship between The Observer and Capital Public Radio, and kind of recognizing that we're better together. I am a big believer in you want to go fast, go alone. You want to go far, go together. It's an old African proverb. And I just think that particularly in media, collaboration is really important. The Observer is in several collaborations, but the relationship with Cap Radio to me is something that is very unique. We, as you say, we share Srishti, and they've been doing a great job on K-12 education reporting. It's the idea of sharing content to me is something that is really important, particularly when you've got diverse voices that are helping to lead that. I think we're a better newsroom when we can collaborate with organizations like Cap Radio to, you know, get better insights and learnings about, you know, effective media communications. And I think you guys are a better newsroom when you include, you know, leadership like ours, you know, and the viewpoint and the sensitivity of our community. So everything from not just the reporting that Srishti's doing, but then like, you know, photography and those types of things, making sure that, you know, our community is well represented in your reporting to me means a lot. And so, you know, we partner with that. We also partner together with Solving Sacramento as well, too, which is focusing right now on affordable housing issues, but other issues as well, too. So I'm very appreciative of the relationship we've had the last few years with Cap Radio.
Yeah, I agree that thoughtfulness is just so important. And it's really difficult when the only constant to journalism, regardless the medium, is change.
Yes.
And often doing more with less. You know, given that other news outlets in recent years, they've been starting to invest in DEI beats, which is diversity, equity, inclusion, mm-hmm. you know, race and culture reporters. What is your view on that?
I think it's important. I think communities are better when local newsrooms are healthy and are investing and reporting on the entire community. I don't think people say, well, does that mean that there's still relevance to the black press? I feel like there's always going to be relevance to the black press. I think no matter what the work is that other newsrooms do related to race and culture and the work that they're doing, they should do it because they're also reaching an audience that we are might not be reaching. And so that community needs to be informed of those issues. But I will say that our reporting is unique. Our perspective is unique. Our connection with the community is unique. The voices that we include in our publication are unique. And so there's just some nuances that we have when we cover our community week in, week out for 60 years. But I applaud newsrooms that have that and use that as, you know, a guiding light within their newsroom. I want to make sure that they continue with that effort because it was in fashion after George Floyd, and it needs to continue. And so I would urge them to continue to do that and then to create partnerships like with newsrooms like ours as well, too, because I think that's important.
Yeah, we're better in numbers, absolutely. You know, and when we work together. Larry, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
And that is Larry Lee, the publisher and president of the Sacramento Observer, which was recently named the best Black newspaper in the United States. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California's Reparations Task Force is a first-in-the-nation initiative by a state to understand and undo the scope of harm and injustices against Black Californians. After 2 years of research and passionate public hearings, the task force has compiled an extensive report, as well as a long list of recommendations to correct the generations of outright and systemic racism in our state. This is one of the nine task members, State Senator Stephen Bradford, on the final meeting in Sacramento.
Let's be clear and honest. The cost of reparations will be high, but make no mistake, the harms that are done are just as high.
And it might sound like a new approach for government to take accountability, but reparations have happened many, many times in the United States and in world history. In our country, reparations began a few years after the Declaration of Independence and have continued in the centuries since. Some examples include reparations for Native Americans, to Japanese Americans incarcerated during World War II, and globally, Germany's reparations to Holocaust survivors. But a report more than 1,000 pages long, coupled with more than 200 recommendations, still has a long road ahead to become effective. The task force's work is now in the hands of state lawmakers. We're going to hear from a member of the California task force in just a minute, but first we're going to start with a journalist who's been following this from the beginning and has been joining us a few times with updates on Insight. That is Annalise Finney, a reporter with KQED. Welcome.
Hey, Vicky, great to be back.
And it's kind of full circle now. You know, you joined us a few times in the past, you know, year and a half or so. Okay, so CalMatters, I was looking at their article and they had this powerful snapshot of everything that took place in the past 2 years with the California Reparations Task Force, close to 200 hours of public hearings, more than 100 witnesses. The report is over 1,000 pages long. It includes more than 100 or I believe more than 200 recommendations. I mean, that is dizzying if you're just dipping your toe, stepping into this. But you've been really chronicling this since the beginning, taking it in firsthand. How do you explain everything that unfolded to someone who's really learning about it for the first time?
That's a great question. I think when I sit down with people to talk about reparations who really aren't familiar with the idea, I like to use a metaphor to help people understand what the task force set out to do. And the metaphor I often turn to is the idea of a car crash, that when you're driving along, if you hit somebody else's car in the U.S., you don't just wave out the window and say, oh, I'm sorry, and keep going. You're required to make that car work again. You're supposed to pay for the repairs and make sure that when it gets back on the road, it's safe and able to do its job the same as your car. And in the U.S., we really never did that for Black people who were enslaved at the beginning of this country's history. And so when we look at reparations, it's really that movement of repair, trying to make Black people's experience in the state and in the country what it should have been.
When you take a step back, what moments and conversations bubble up to the surface?
I think one thing that stands out to me that was consistently surprising and refreshing was how deep the task force dug into the history of this state. I grew up in California. I went to public school here, and I learned things every meeting that I didn't know about how the state systematically oppressed the Black population since its founding.
You were in Sacramento at the final meeting of the task force. This was at the end of June. You sent us a clip of one of the reparations task force members, Lisa Holder, on that day. Let's take a listen.
Here is a document that tells us the full story. We are not post-racial. And I would recommend to anyone who is legislating or creating laws in this country, anyone who says that we are colorblind, that we have solved the problem of anti-Black animus and racism, I challenge you to read this document and try and come out with that position.
And you really touched upon that, not only as a journalist, but just as a person taking it in, learning something new every time you went to one of these public hearings. I mean, the final meeting, I would imagine, was a pretty momentous occasion. You know, what was the scene like inside the room?
So the final meeting took place at the Secretary of State's auditorium, and Secretary of State Shirley Weber is the person who brought forth the legislation to create this body to study and come up with a plan for reparations. So being back in the Secretary of State's home essentially was really bringing the task force full circle in its work. There at times throughout the meetings over the last 2 years have been some controversy, hardship, disagreement between the members, but the last meeting felt really celebratory. I think people really understood the historic nature of this moment, that the state is the first in the country to really systematically study this oppression and come up with a plan for how to fix it.
Yeah. I mean, given that this dates back centuries and generations, the report is understandably extensive, as are the recommendations. But what recommendations stand out the most to you?
I think one of the things that stands out to me is the depth of the policy proposals. So this final recommendation report has a lot of different components. There's a recommendation for an official apology. There's a plan for direct compensation. And then there are dozens of policy proposals that are meant to stop harm moving forward and continue repair in sectors that are not addressed through direct compensation. And I think for me, the thing that stands out is the depth of these policy proposals. I mean, it includes things like making the election, the National Election Day, a holiday, so a paid holiday for employees. It includes things like ending the practice of banning books in state prisons, removing lead from water across the state, things that are very broad and really cover all sectors of life in the state. And if they were to be enacted, would truly be a revolutionary change in the way we live our lives here.
One of the proposals that has made the rounds in a lot of articles, it comes, you know, when talking about, you know, direct cash payments. And that is one of the more contentious proposals that the task force weighed, you know, cash payments for eligible Black Californians. And these calculations can be very complicated. But in some news articles, some estimates are potentially more than $1 million for someone who's eligible. What should listeners know about this proposal?
Well, as you said, that number is the kind of most that somebody might be eligible for. But to get there, there's a lot of things that somebody would have to prove. This task force decided that they would only provide this type of direct compensation, or they recommend that the state only provide this compensation to people who can prove direct ancestral lineage to somebody who was enslaved in the United States. On top of that, they recommend that the payments be prioritized for people who are older first, and then perhaps for people who are younger. There would be a residency requirement that has yet to be entirely determined. They make some suggestions, but that would ultimately be up to the legislature to decide. And in conversations with the task force chair, she said that, you know, look, maybe this sounds like a lot of money, but as Senator Bradford said in the quote that you played at the beginning of this conversation, there is a lot of harm. And this is ultimately what is due. This is what has been calculated by economic experts retained by the task force who studied specific harms that the community has suffered that have really taken wealth out of the community systemically for generations.
Any idea how many Black residents in the state could be eligible?
You know, that's a hard number to pin down. There are about 2.5 million Black people in the state of California, but only some of those would be eligible. I found a number from a 2014 report that says about 200,000 Black people are people who have immigrated to the United States after the end of the 1800s. So those people would potentially be excluded under the suggested eligibility rules. But, you know, this one thing that came up a lot at the task force is even if somebody is eligible, proving it could be hard. So it's kind of hard to say how many people would ultimately receive these checks if this is something that was approved by the legislature and the state and the governor.
Yeah, even though what we're talking about is a big milestone, we have a final report and recommendations. It's really the end of one chapter, and another chapter is beginning in this journey. There's now a legislative road ahead. Whether these recommendations actually turn into bills that are laws signed by the governor, that remains to be seen. State Senator Stephen Bradford, who's a member on the task force, he touched upon this.
This has got to be a start of another lengthy process. We won't do it in one legislative cycle. We won't do it in one bill. But we need, again, all of you to stay engaged, to let your voices be heard, let be seen.
And you interviewed State Senator Bradford as well. I mean, not only is he a task force member, but he also has the perspective of being in the state legislature for more than a decade. What did you learn about him, about the road and the challenges ahead?
Well, as he references in that quote, it's going to be a push. And I think he was very focused on sort of being a realist about this. This is a long road. He said the earliest legislation might be introduced would be this coming December, but really this is likely to be a multi-year process. He said that him and the other legislator who was part of the task force, Assemblyman Reginald Jones Sawyer, will be spearheading this effort in the legislature. They both term out next year, so after that, it'll be taken up by the Legislative Black Caucus, which is a 12-member sort of sub-body within the legislature. But he said that, you know, really, we need people to read these recommendations. We need people to read the history that underpins these recommendations. That's also part of the task force's final report. And he says that if this is really going to be something that becomes law, they're going to need not only broad public support, but also allies within this legislature, people who are themselves not Black, who understand that this is something that is essential to creating a more equitable state. Hmm.
Finally, I mean, when it comes to, you know, the public support as well as lawmakers, it's been 2 weeks since the state legislature has received this report. It has been public for 2 weeks. What has the response been so far?
You know, I have to say, maybe this is something that Member Tamaki can answer a little bit better later on, but I have not heard much. I mean, as you mentioned, it's a big report. There's a lot to get through. The legislature is headed into its summer break. But, you know, this is where the rubber really hits the road. I think a lot of legislators have sort of been relying on this report not being out yet and saying, oh, I support this, but I haven't seen the report yet, so I can't take a stance. So, you know, hopefully we'll be hearing more soon. But at the moment, I have to say I haven't heard that much.
Well, Annalise, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, Vicky, for having me.
Annalise Finney is a reporter with KQED and has been following the California Reparations Task Force, explaining the final report and recommendations that is 2 years in the making. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. We're going to continue our conversation with Don Tamaki, who was one of the 9 members of the California Reparations Task Force, known for his own historic legal work following the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. Don, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
So you were a significant part of 2 years of historic work. How are you feeling now that the report has been handed off to the state legislature?
Well, it's a monumental job. And bear in mind, this has never been done before anywhere. This is the first time that any government entity has taken a look at 400 years of oppression. So getting to the 1,100-page final report with its recommendations is groundbreaking. The only other government report that made such an attempt was the 1968 Kerner Commission report following the uprisings and unrest in the cities. That report made dire predictions if the United States didn't address these issues. All of those predictions turned out to be true, and that report was largely ignored. So our task is really to make sure that this report resonates throughout the country.
Given that now this is in the hands of the state legislature and it's up to lawmakers to craft policies and bills and that hopefully become law, where do you see your work now, given that's an unknown road ahead?
I think we have to move the needle of public opinion. as Annalise Finney discussed, this history is largely erased. I thought I knew something about American history before we began this two-year journey. I considered myself well-read in American history, My conclusion now is that my understanding then was not even close. And like Annalise has said, even those who are steeped in this history, American history, African American history, will learn something new from the report. And with respect to California, it uncovered and shined a light on things that we had no idea. I mean, California did enter the Union in 1850 as a non-slave state, but it was plenty complicit with the institution of slavery and all of the effects of Jim Crow that followed for the next 100 years.
And you were appointed by the governor to this task force because you were integral when it came to justice for Japanese Americans incarcerated during World War II. You worked pro bono during the Supreme Court case that overturned the conviction of Fred Korematsu, who refused to be incarcerated. How did that experience prepare you to be part of California's reparation task force for Black Californians?
Well, it was a 20-year journey looking into our own history that the public had no idea had even happened. I recall when we were filing to reopen this historic landmark case, 1944 case, which upheld the constitutionality of the mass roundup, newspaper reporters, really educated people said, did this happen in America? Aren't we talking about prisoners of war? They did not know it happened to American citizens. And then similarly, the state of the public's understanding of what's happened following slavery in particular is very scant, if not, you know, non-existent. So part of this is educating the public about this wrong that not only occurred, but was continuing right up through into the modern era. So we've launched, for example, a endorsement campaign in which organizations have endorsed, and so far there are 360 organizations, including mainstream organizations like the Los Angeles County Bar Association, Sacramento Bar, Alameda County in San Francisco, major philanthropies like the California Wellness Foundation and the Weingart Foundation, organizations in the faith community, in the social service and civil rights groups that are basically saying it's time. It's time to study this and seriously consider it, pass legislation for it. I would say that the harm is long in the making. We're talking about centuries in the making. So the repairs have to be long in the implementation. And so we're not talking about a one and done bill. We're talking about a commitment that California has to make to begin the process of repair. And certainly some of it is individual compensation. But I want to remind the listeners that that's a small part of the more than 115 proposals for reform in healthcare, in education, in housing, in just about every metric in which Native people and Black people are at the bottom in California.
This could take years.
It could take years, and but no wonder. I mean, the iteration after iteration of what had happened is breathtaking. And so, for example, San Francisco in 2021, the Black infant mortality rate is five times that of white babies. That alone is intolerable and cannot and has to be fixed. It's going to take longer than 1 year or one bill to do that. And so that's just a slight example, one small example of all of the things that are outlined in the report that have resulted from these disparities that have resulted from a continuing, I'll call it a racial pathology, that morphed into one form or another and created outcomes that we're living with today.
I mean, you really are emphasizing that public opinion is crucial in this and implementing these recommendations, but public opinion is more nuanced. Ahead of the final report, the Public Policy Institute of California, they shared residents' views of racism, but also the legacy of slavery. So the vast majority of Californians, 8 in 10, they believe racism is still a problem today. but that drops to roughly half when asked if the legacy of slavery impacts Black Californians today. And it drops even further to like 43% when asked if they have a favorable view of the task force that you're a part of. I mean, as you know, these residents are constituents. How do you think that will shape the political will at the state legislature?
Well, public opinion has always shaped the political will. And when we started our redress and reparations effort, I think the public basically had two answers, no and hell no. But that was before this public education campaign was launched. And one of the common misperceptions is that this is all about slavery. And it ended in 1865, the playing field is level. So what is the problem? Well, the problem is that after slavery ended, the policies of exclusion and deprivation simply continued in one form or another. For example, in the 1940s, about 80% of the deeds of houses and homes had racially restrictive covenants barring Black families from moving in. Between the 1934 and 1962, approximately $120 billion was issued by the federal government to create America's middle class that allowed primarily white families to become homeowners. But 98% of those loans went to white people. Social Security, products of the new, outcomes of the New Deal. We think of lifting America out of a depression, but it largely excluded African Americans. So this sort of continuing pattern persisted. Redlining, for example, which was used by, these maps were used by lenders to determine who was eligible for loans, again, to acquire ownership in homes. If you align the redlining maps between the 1930s right through the 1960s with the today's maps of the most underserved, impoverished, polluted neighborhoods in California, they align exactly. So that these events of the past, and I'm going to say the recent past, the not too distant past, created our current outcomes, which are astounding. The difference between Black and white households in terms of net worth is 9 times the wealth gap. And so this is not about slavery. This is about a continuing policy of exclusion in which individuals aligned with government cooperated to separate California and America into white and Black neighborhoods with other people of color somewhere in between as well. So the issue of reparations is much broader than slavery. It's much broader than a check in the mail. It shines a light basically on something that originated in 1619, simply continued throughout the centuries.
It brings up the question also, how will this be funded? Will taxpayers help fund this? Because many people, as you know, struggle with the cost of living in California. They are vulnerable for a myriad of reasons, and followed by California currently has a budget shortfall of more than $30 billion.
Yeah, the budgets will, there'll be at times when it'll be difficult and there'll be times when the state will be flush. But what we're saying is this is a societal debt that has to be planned for annually and like everything else. And taxpayers, we're paying for societal debt all the time, whether it arises from wars, natural catastrophes, public work projects, Social Security. A 2010 study of federal payments found that taxpayers are still paying for to the descendants of Civil War veterans benefits. So unlike something that happened incidentally in one year or the next, this was something that spanned the centuries. It's also something that created huge amounts of wealth for the entire country and for California in particular. When we think about, for example, freeways and barrier rapid transit and parks and upscale development, and the placement of companies and industries that enhance the productivity and wealth of entire regions, we agree that those are part of the societal good things that happened. But in looking at that closely, many of them were run right through African-American neighborhoods. Between 1949 and 1973, there were approximately 2,500 eminent domain projects. That is projects for the public good in 992 cities, but 1 million people got displaced. And 2/3 of those people were African Americans. So this is not something involving just an aggrieved minority. This is a debt that has not been paid and not been acknowledged, and for which the public has been largely unaware. And so the Reparations Task Force is saying it's time to take a look at this.
Don, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
Don Tamaki is one of the 9 members of California's Reparation Task Force, known for his historic legal work following the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. From the foothills through Sacramento to the Bay, the summer concert scene is starting to sizzle like the upcoming heat wave. I think it's like 112 this weekend. Joining us again to cap off our week of shows with their top picks for upcoming live music is CAP Radio music host Nick Bruner and Andrew Garcia. Hello.
Is it going to be up to 112?
That's what I saw.
Weekend? How do you say that with such a chipper lilt
well,
in your voice?
I'm looking at the both of you. You make it easier.
Oh, so. That's wow. Boy, she's good at this.
Quite nice.
Yeah. Every time I think I got ice her. Cubes, you know. So
you're very welcome.
All right, Andrew, I'm going to start off with you. Actually, this is pretty fitting. First up, you have Pool Kids, and they are an American math rock emo band. What is math rock?
Yeah, to break it all down, you said American math rock band, America. They're American. Easy enough. Math rock, we've talked about on the show before with Sosis. It's sort of a genre driven by rhythmic complexity of like the drums and guitar lines. Lots of syncopation, odd time signatures, breakdowns, all that fun stuff. And you've got emo, which is emotional music that's, in touch with its feelings. Those feelings can range from sad and melancholic to like angsty and angry and full of rage.
Take that, Dad.
Yeah. I'm going to go to the pool. the great things, the thing that I really like about Pool Kids, though, is that they encompass that entire emotional spectrum of emo. So in one song, you'll get like the beautiful introspective melancholy of like regrets, and then you'll get the screaming angst of like a tough breakup.
Yeah, you're bringing back my emo years of high school and college where it's like, they just understand me. My parents don't.
Yes.
So their Pool Kids is going to be playing Friday night at Bottom of the Hill in San Francisco. So let's get a little taste. This is the single, That's Physics, Baby. Yeah, I'm definitely getting that math rock feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're counting along. It's the odd time signatures. Yes, it's very fun.
So your next pick, Andrew, is Cuffed Up, and they're going to be performing right around the corner, July 17th, mm-hmm. Monday, at the Starlit Room in Sacramento. How did you get involved, or how did you first get a taste of Cuffed Up?
I was looking around to see what sort of bands are coming. There's, you know, the way it sort of goes, looking for stuff. There's bands that are already on my radar that I'm excited about, already know that they're on their way. And then I'll just scour around. And I saw Cuffed Up, and they're super great. They've got a lot of 90s energy, some grunginess, some garage fuzz, a bit of shoegaziness at times. And those are all really like hallmark genre of 90s groups. But this is sort of in the new and a new sort of spin on it. And it's very good.
And they've been compared to Sonic Youth and the Pixies. Is there like a 90s feel to them?
I think so. I think with the genre, and they also, similar to the Pixies and Sonic Youth, sort of switch off between male and female lead vocals. And so there's a lot of that fun interplay that you get with bands like them.
All right. Well, let's take a listen to Small Town Kid by Cuffed Up. That is Cuffed Up. We'll be playing at the Starlit Room on Monday, July 17th in Sacramento. Okay, Nick, it's your turn.
Okay.
You're up. Toon Yards.
Toon Yards. One of my favorite groups for so many years. I love this duo. Meryl Garbus is largely the person who's like looked at as like the brain, the person who's really behind the band Toon Yards, and largely correct, but often overlooked is her writing partner Nate Brenner. Together, they make this loop-based art rock. Started off in Oakland early off in their career, which likely led to them scoring the film "Sorry to Bother You" by Boots Riley. If you haven't seen that, excellent, excellent. Mm. Some of the edges of their music lately have been kind of smoothed off, which is fine by me. I like the melodic offerings, but I'm also curious about what they're going to sound like if they go to sort of their back catalog, like their like tracks from like 2009's Bird Brains or a song like Gangsta. But like, here's a good example of what I mean by a smoother sound. This is from their most recent record, Sketchy. It's called Hold Yourself, and it's one of my favorites.
All right, and that is Toon Yards, who is playing with Os Mutantes up in the foothills at Grass Valley August 23rd.
August 23rd, yeah, such a fantastic venue, I think, especially for those two bands together, Os Mutantes and Toon Yards together. That should be a fantastic, fantastic show. If you can hear my voice, Grass Valley, get your tickets.
Yeah, I love Grass Valley. Foothills are beautiful. Okay, last up, we only got a couple of minutes, the Mountain Goats, Nick.
Get your tickets now. October 7th may seem a little ways away off in your calendar, but it's going to be worth it, and I bet this sells out pretty, pretty hard. John Darnielle, master lyricist, often writing songs and albums around a theme. The latest example being Bleed Out, tracks that were all inspired by 70s and 80s action film sequences. I'm going to play this one. It's about wrestling. It's from their 2015 record, Beat the Champ. This is a track called Foreign Object. It's delightful. We'll be right back.
square in the spotlight, sweating real hard. All soaked in blood, like a newborn babe, sharp thing hidden in my hand, shaped like an astrolabe. Gonna stick you in the eye with a foreign object. Gonna poke you in the eye with a foreign object.
Now I know why our producer Nick was laughing. Well, he was chuckling along to the lyrics while he was producing this.
The whole thing is so smart and so wonderful. It's this like wonderful, like smooth, melodic, but like salt and vinegar lyrics. It's excellent.
Stab you in the arm with a foreign object. Well, on that note, not with both of you. You guys are my ice cubes during the heat wave.
HR is just down the hall.
And that is CAP Radio host Nick Bruner and Andrew Garcia with another round of Insights Concert Connect. As always, you can hear all modern music on Hey Listen, CAP Radio Saturday from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. and again from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Corral Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.